hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought to die to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the fog of death. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on White Resistance Radio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, of course. Sorry, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, so much to do and so much to talk about today. Anyway, this is Christmas Day, or actually it's Christmas night. I want to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas. I trust you all had a wonderful Christmas, hopefully with family, as I did. And today, well, it's now today, but on the 26th, I'll be having some political friends in for supper. These are some of my close friends and associates. And then this weekend, I'll be having my too late for Christmas, too early for New Year's annual party for my political friends in the Toronto Hamilton area. So that's what I'll be doing. I want to go over a little bit about Christmas. I've stressed the importance, and I'm sure many of you did do this, wishing people Merry Christmas in public, in businesses, and so on. Taking back our feast. It's our feast. And by our, I mean, if you're a Christian, and I imagine most of you are, well, that very definitely is a Christian celebration. No big mystery here, celebrating the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. If you're not a Christian, but you're a European, you probably celebrate it as a secular celebration. And that makes sense. It's become, at least for the last hundred and some years, it's become very much part of who we are. Talk about a nice, innocuous sort of celebration. A time of giving, a time of family, a time of celebrating joy and so on. Lots of fun with Santa Claus and the anticipation for presents. A reminder that perhaps not everybody is sharing quite probably your good fortune. It's a time to reflect that maybe we should be helping the poor, inviting somebody who perhaps has no family or no family present to dinner. In every way, it's ultra wonderful and positive. So from the whether it's from the religious point of view or the secular, it's a wonderful feast, a wonderful time. And I urge people not to be intimidated. Don't give in to the, well, you know, not everybody celebrates it. So what? Not everybody celebrates Ramadan. Do the Muslims give up on it? You wouldn't want to offend anybody. Come on. Jews have various celebrations like Purim and Hanukkah. Very often they celebrate some event where the Jewish people got the better of their foreigners or enemies, unlike Christmas, which celebrates life, birth, positive things. But does anybody, do the Jews say, well, we better not celebrate these feasts or festivals because, well, some people don't. Well, in fact, most people don't. The Jews constitute perhaps 2% of the United States, less than 1% of Canada. My point being, you shouldn't have to give a flip if some people don't celebrate it. That's their business. They don't have to celebrate. And when you wish somebody Merry Christmas, you're not compelling them to celebrate it. You're expressing your culture. And we have got to start aggressively celebrating our culture and our heroes. I was at supper tonight talking a little bit about Canadian history and parts of Canadian history that are no longer widely taught. For instance, the story of Dollard des Armeaux. Now, Dollard des Armeaux was a young French-Canadian. I think he was about 18 or 19. He and a small band of fellow young men had heard that the Iroquois were going to attack down the Ottawa River and attack the settlement at Montreal. This is in the middle of the 17th century. He was a brash young man, a courageous young man, and so he went up the Ottawa River, built a small fort in the hopes that he could interdict the attacking Iroquois before they reached Montreal. And Montreal was not very well defended. And if the Iroquois came in sufficient numbers, they might well have overrun the white settlement there and massacred them. Dollard des Armeaux held out on this fort along the Ottawa River against a much, much larger invading force of Iroquois, and much larger than they even expected. The Iroquois, though, were so stunned by the courage and the ferocity of Dollard des Armeaux and his friends, and even though they were all massacred, they rethought the idea of attacking Montreal. And in fact, Dollard des Armeaux, through his heroism and the heroism of his companions, saved Montreal, saved some of my white European ancestors. Well, we don't hear much about Dollard des Armeaux anymore. Why? Well, you know, Indians, I mean, the First Nations, or Native people, or whatever they want to call themselves these days, Indigenous people, they might be offended. No, too bad. That's part of our history. That doesn't mean they don't have a right to their history. course they do. And I'm always reminded of a great line from one of the Smothers Brothers songs. And the Smothers Brothers were popular in the 60s and 70s. They were two brothers, obviously. And they did a lot of comic songs. And one song had a line that I often thought is relevant to virtue-signaling, self-hating whites. And that is, "I drank to your health till I ruined my own. I drank to your health till I ruined my own." It's comic. It's funny. But there's a truth in that. We don't elevate somebody else's culture by suppressing our own. I have a good deal of admiration for the Japanese. Among other things, they celebrate New Year's. Each year is a a zodiac sign. I believe the year starting that will start on January 1st of the year of the rat. And there's legend and so on attached to that. And it's a time of gift giving and family togetherness. And when I was in Japan, I was told and obviously this is the case, and basically New Year's is the big celebration. Christmas, much, much less so, even though some people celebrate it as a secular event. There are actually very, very few Christians in Japan. But anyway, the Japanese have this celebration. Now, no Japanese should have to feel, well, I better not celebrate New Year because, it might leave some people out. Well, no, so it leaves them out. Or there's no reason why they can't celebrate it too, if they want. And I think we should be proud of our tradition. You know, pride engenders respect. Weakness and retreat engender disgust. You know, hey, if you don't even want to celebrate, if you're ashamed of your culture, or you feel it's almost something dirty or sordid, well, I don't want to say Merry Christmas. Well, why should anybody else respect you? You know, I think it's a basic of human behavior. We respect strength. We respect confidence. And, it raises the question, if you're not confident about your own culture, why should anybody else respect it? I think of the British experience in India. When the British mostly rulers, a few colonists, but the British began coming to India in the middle of the 18th century, and throughout the glorious 19th century, they came in with full confidence that theirs was the best civilization on earth. Tempered sometimes by Christianity and the recognition that we are all flawed and so on. But nonetheless, looking around the world, and of course the British had colonies right around the world. In fact, right up until 1960, they even say that the sun never set on the British Empire. It had colonies all around the world. And the British set out with a belief in their own value. Britain was was a ferocious industrial power in the 19th century. All sorts of great things manufactured in Britain. Steam power had originated in Britain. There was the steam engine, the railway. Britain had a great deal to be confident about. And when they arrived in India and rubbed shoulders with several ancient civilizations, Hinduism, the Muslim conquests in the Northwest, they had a great impact on these civilizations. People recognized the superiority of the English justice system. Justice was no longer meted out by the local ruler, who might be benevolent and kind or might be a vicious tyrant. Certain practices were outlawed that offended basic human dignity. For instance, the practice of suti, which is the a woman would throw herself on her husband's funeral pyre, the bodies would be cremated, and the British outlawed this. They also outlawed certain other practices, and for the rest, though, the British left the Indians to their own devices. In other words, they were allowed to practice their culture. It wasn't that the British came and said, "We're great. Your culture is crap. You've got to become like us." In many ways, they let the people in India continue to practice their native culture, their native languages, and so on. But with the overlay of British administration, British education, and British law. And the Indians snapped it up. The Indians gravitated to that. In fact, there's a whole group of Indians in India, the Anglo-Indians, who in many ways were more British than the British. And even to this day, British culture, tea time, a respect for British learning is pervasive in India. And the reason for that was, by their confidence, the British inspired the Indians. Because they showed confidence in their own culture, the Indians, because the British showed confidence in their own culture, the Indians accepted a great deal of it. They saw that it was superior to what they had. Not that everything in India is inferior and everything British was great, but in general. And the confidence inspired the Indians to say, this is worthwhile. We want to be like that. We see the value of the British, of English common law. We see the value of representative government, the parliamentary system. And India has had its independence since for 71 years, since 1948. And has become the world's largest democracy. It's not perfect. There are problems around the edges, but parliamentary democracy has worked, and the application of English common law. The courts may not be 100%, but they certainly are. They certainly deliver a great deal better justice than many other places in Asia. And the British were quite happy the Indians were quite happy to accept this. They saw the superiority of the British way in many cases. And part of the reason for that was the British behaved in a confident manner. They were not disrespectful to the locals. They didn't say, "Well, nothing in your culture is any good. You're crap. We're great." But they simply showed that what they had was indeed better. And being reasonably intelligent persons, much of India went along with that. Well, here's a bit of an overview of Christmas. Christmas, of course, is the Christian festival celebrating the birth of Jesus. The term Christmas, Mass on Christ's Day or Christ's Mass, is of fairly recent origin. The earlier term Yule may have been derived from the Germanic Yule or the Anglo-Saxon Yule, which referred to the feast of the winter solstice, which is, of course, the 21st of December, the shortest day of the year, which occurs very close to Christmas. the corresponding terms in other languages, Navidad in Spanish, Natale in Italian, Noel in French, all probably denote nativity. The German word Weihnachten denotes hallowed night or holy night, hence the hymn, O Holy Night. Since the early 20th century, Christmas has also been a secular family holiday observed by Christians and non-Christians alike, devoid of Christian elements and marked by an increasingly elaborate exchange of gifts. In this secular Christmas celebration, a mythical figure named Santa Claus plays a pivotal role. I might not totally agree with that. Santa Claus is based on a Christian saint, Saint Nicholas. The early Christian community distinguished between the identification of the date of Jesus' birth and the liturgical celebration of that event. The actual observance of the day of Jesus' birth was long in coming, particularly during the first two centuries of Christianity, when there was a strong opposition to recognizing birthdays of martyrs, or for that matter, of Jesus. Numerous church fathers offered sarcastic comments about the pagan custom of celebrating birthdays, when in fact, saints and martyrs should be honored on the days of their martyrdom, their true birthdays, from the church's perspective. Now, I think that's faded away, but that's interesting. The precise origin of assigning December 25th as the birth date of Jesus is unclear. The New Testament provides no clues in this regard. December 25th was first identified as the date of Jesus' birth by Sextus Julius Africanus in 221 AD, and later became the universally accepted date. One widespread explanation of the origin of this date is that December 25th was the Christianizing of the Dies Solis Invicti Nati, that is, the day of the birth of the unconquered sun, or the 21st of December, the winter solstice. And the Christian church was actually very adept at incorporating ideas from the pagans, the pre-Christian religions, into Christianity, where there was no conflict. Rather than saying, everything you believed in is garbage, Christianity tried quite often to incorporate compatible elements. For instance, in the Acts of the Apostles, one of the apostles goes to a town, and they have many gods. The pre-Christian religions, especially in the Greek and Roman empires, had numerous gods. There wasn't one god; there were numerous. And in that town, they had an altar. A little shrine or temple to the unknown God. And because the people in the town didn't want to forget any God, and in case they had missed one, they wanted to honor the God. And what the apostle said was, well, I will tell you about this God that you don't know, that you didn't want to leave him out, and I'll tell you about him, and of course that was Jesus Christ. Now, that was very clever, and that was often the way that the early church proceeded. Anyway, the Romans had this celebration of the Dies, that's day, Solis, that's of the sun, Invicti, that's unconquered, Nati, so it's the day of the birth of the unconquered sun. And it was a popular holiday in the Roman Empire that celebrated the winter solstice as a symbol of the resurgence of the sun. December 21st is the shortest day of the year, and then the sun begins to grow stronger, the days longer after that. And celebrated the casting away of winter and the heralding of the rebirth of spring and summer. Indeed, after December 25th had become widely accepted as the date of Jesus' birth, Christian writers frequently made the connection between the rebirth of the sun and the birth of the sun, S-O-N, of God. One of the difficulties with this view is that it suggests a nonchalant willingness on the part of the Christian church to appropriate a pagan festival when the early church was so intent on distinguishing itself categorically from pagan beliefs and practices. A second view suggests that December 25th became the date of Jesus' birth by a priori reasoning that identified the spring equinox as the date of the creation of the world and the fourth day of creation when the light was created as the day of Jesus' conception, that is, March 25th. December 25th, 9 months later, then became the date of Jesus' birth. For a long time, the celebration of Jesus' birth was observed in conjunction with his baptism, which is normally celebrated on January the 6th, and that is the Christmas for the Eastern Rite Catholic churches, like the Ukrainian Catholic, and the Orthodox churches, the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, etc. Christmas began to be widely celebrated with a specific liturgy in the 9th century, but did not attain the liturgical importance of either Good Friday or Easter, the other two major Christian holidays. Roman Catholic churches celebrate the first Christmas Mass at midnight, and Protestant churches have increasingly held Christmas candlelight services late on the evening of December 24th. A special service of lessons and carols intertwines Christmas carols with scriptural readings narrating the salvation history from the fall in the Garden of Eden to the coming of Christ. The service, inaugurated by E.W. Benson and adopted by the University of Cambridge, has become widely popular. And then we go now to contemporary customs in the West. None of the contemporary Christmas customs have their origin in theological or liturgical affirmations, and most are of fairly recent date. The Renaissance humanist Sebastian Brandt recorded in Das Narrenschiff, 1494, or the Ship of Fools, the custom of placing branches of fir trees in houses. Even though there's some uncertainty about the precise date and origin of the tradition of the Christmas tree, it appears that fir trees decorated with apples were first known in Strasbourg in 1605. And there's a number of reasons for that. Fir, of course, fir trees are very, very pleasant in scent, in their smell, very nice aroma. And in times when they didn't have air fresheners or whatever, and houses could get quite dirty. there'd be a strong decorative advantage to using fir branches for this way. I've got to excuse myself here. The first use of candles on such trees is recorded by a Silesian duchess in 1611. Silesia is now occupied by Poland, a traditional German area in Poland, anyway. The Advent wreath, made of fir branches with four candles denoting the four Sundays of Advent, that's the month before Christmas, or the month of December, is of even more recent origin, especially in North America. The custom, which began in the 19th century but had roots in the 16th, originally involved a fir wreath with 24 candles, that's the 24 days before Christmas, starting December the 1st. But the awkwardness of having so many candles on the wreath reduced the number to four. An analogous custom is the Advent calendar, which has 24 openings, one to be opened each day before December 1st. Each day beginning December 1st. I hope many of you have actually had one of these or seen one of them. According to the tradition, the calendar was created in the 19th century by a Munich housewife who, tired of having to answer endlessly when Christmas would come. The first commercial calendars were printed in Germany in 1851. The intense preparation for Christmas that is part of the commercialization of the holiday has blurred the traditional liturgical distinction between Advent and the Christmas season, as can be seen by the placement of Christmas trees in sanctuaries well before December 25th. Toward the end of the 18th century, the practice of giving gifts to family members became well established. Theologically, the feast day reminded Christians of God's gift of Jesus to mankind, even as the coming of the wise men or the Magi to Bethlehem suggested that Christmas was somehow related to giving gifts. And of course, the the wise men, probably from what's now Iran or Persia, were people who paid attention to the signs and the stars. And these would be probably the Zoroastrians. And a star told them that a great event, probably a birth, was happening, and they followed the star, so the Bible tells us, until the light shone on the stable in Bethlehem, and the wise men brought their gifts. And they were bringing gifts to honor the child who would become the savior of mankind. And that's another way that gift-giving has been associated with Christmas. The practice of giving gifts, which goes back to the 15th century, contributed to the view that Christmas was a secular holiday focused on family and friends. This was one reason why Puritans in Old and New England opposed the celebration of Christmas, and in both England and America succeeded in banning its observance. And yes, not all Christians celebrated Christmas, although now it'd be only a very tiny number that would, for their own peculiar theological reasons, not to celebrate it. The tradition of celebrating Christmas as a secular family holiday is splendidly illustrated in a number of English Christmas carols, such as Here We Come A-Wassailing. Wassail is a mixed drink of, I believe, wine and apple juice and so on, or Deck the Halls with Boughs of Holly. It can also be seen in the practice of sending Christmas cards, which began in England in the 19th century. Moreover, in countries such as Austria and Germany, the connection between the Christian festival and the family holiday is made by identifying the Christ child as the giver of gifts to the family. In some European countries, St. Nicholas, or Santa Claus, appears on his feast day, December the 6th, bringing modest gifts of candy and other gifts to children. In North America, the pre-Christmas role of the Christian St. Nicholas was transformed under the influence of the poem A Visit from St. Nicholas, or 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, into the increasingly central role of Santa Claus as the source of Christmas gifts for the family. While both name and attire, a version of the traditional dress of a bishop, of Santa Claus reveal his Christian roots, and his role of querying children about their past behavior replicates that of St. Nicholas. He's seen as a secular figure in Australia, where people attend open-air concerts of Christmas carols and have their Christmas dinner on the beach, Santa Claus wearing red swimming trunks as well as a white beard. Well, of course, that's adapting to the environment. December 25th is the middle of Australia's summer, and very, very hot in most parts of Australia. The tradition that Santa Claus wants an accounting from children of their past behavior is actually a good moral lesson. The song... he's making a list, he's checking it twice, he's going to find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. a good moral lesson. In most European countries, gifts are exchanged on Christmas Eve, December 24th, in keeping with the notion of the baby Jesus being born the night of the 24th. The morning of December 25th has become the time of exchange of gifts in North America. In 17th and 18th century Europe, the modest exchange of gifts took place in the early hours of the 25th when the family returned home from Christmas Mass. And that was always the tradition in my family, that we waited until we got home from morning Mass to open the gifts. Or later, if family was coming over, we would postpone it until you know, the late afternoon or the round before or after the supper hour, so everybody could open their gifts together. Although the children in my family were usually allowed to open a gift on Christmas morning. You know, the children, of course, are impatient and excited, and no need to, you know, endlessly frustrate them. In North America, the centrality of the morning of December 25th as the time for the family to open presents has led, with the exception of Catholic and some Lutheran and Episcopalian churches, to the virtual end of holding church services on that day. A striking illustration of the way societal customs influence liturgical practices. In fact, midnight mass is very, very important. Given the importance of Christmas as one of the major Christian feast days, most European countries observe, under the Christian influence, December 26th as a second Christmas holiday. This practice recalls the ancient Christian liturgical notion that the celebration of Christmas, as well as that of Easter and of Pentecost, should last the entire week. The week-long observance, however, was successively reduced to Christmas Day and an additional day, that's December 26th, what we now call Boxing Day. Eastern Orthodox churches honor Christmas on December 25th. However, for those that continue to use the Julian calendar for their liturgical observances, this date corresponds to January 7th in the Gregorian calendar. The churches of the Oriental Orthodox Communion celebrate Christmas variously. For example, in Armenia, the first country to adopt Christianity as its official religion, the church uses its own calendar. The Armenian Apostolic Church honors January 6th as Christmas. In Ethiopia, where Christianity has had a home ever since the 4th century, the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church celebrates Christmas on January the 7th. Most of the churches of the Syriac Orthodox, Patriarch of Antioch, and all the East celebrate Christmas on December 25th. As the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, however, the Syriac Orthodox celebrate Christmas on January the 6th with the Armenian Apostolic Church. Anyway, there's a lot of this gets a little bit arcane. Another big factor, I'll just deal with Christmas in Japan, because I've just been there. Japan serves as an illustration of a different sort. In that predominantly Shinto and Buddhist country, the secular aspect of the holiday, Christmas trees and decorations, even the singing of Christmas songs such as Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer or White Christmas, are widely observed instead of the religious aspects. And that, of course, makes sense, because the vast majority of Japanese, are Shinto and or Buddhist. Probably well over 98%. My guess is be about 99.5%. But they celebrate the secular aspect, the giving of gifts and the general celebration of family and togetherness. What I wanted to mention as well is the influence of certain writers. A story that I always read, actually for 40 years, or watched as a movie, was Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. And that had a tremendous influence on emphasizing the goodness of Christmas. And of course, that's the story is of a man who had some very bad experiences in his youth and become very disillusioned and devoted his entire energy to acquiring wealth. That's, of course, Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge. One Christmas Eve is visited by three spirits or ghosts: Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas yet to come. And they remind him of the importance of others. He'd become how did Dickens describe it? A grasping, covetous, old sinner, a mean, nasty person. And he was inspired by these apparitions or ghosts to rethink things and to get back into the spirit of giving. And so he started to treat his clerk, poor Bob Cratchit, better. He took an interest in Bob Cratchit's crippled son, who the spirit of Christmas future said, you know, would not be around. There would be an empty stool by the fireplace. And he took an interest in him and helped him get better. And, you know, the interesting, famous scene where he opens the window and sees a boy running down the street and tells the boy to go around the corner to the butcher and get that big goose that's hanging in the window. And the little boy says, the goose is big as almost as big as me. And Scrooge says, yes. And that's to be delivered to Bob Cratchit. Anyway, that story is widely, widely read. And has been made into several movies, and that has a big influence on kind of instructing people in you know, the meaning of Christmas. In fact, that's really what the short novel is all about. Well, Merry Christmas. This is Paul Prom. You're on the fighting side of me. I'm going to play some Christmas tunes from this lady I know in Nashville, Tennessee, Julie Keach Harris. This is from her CD, Christmas Dream. And back with you again tomorrow. Merry Christmas to one and all, Julie Keach Harris and Christmas Dream. Thank you.
Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa honey, one little thing I really need, the deed to a platinum mine. Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa cutie, and fill my stocking with a duplex and checks. Sign your ex on the line, Santa cutie, and hurry down the chimney tonight.
Harris, and Santa looked a lot like Daddy, and Daddy looked a lot like him. I'm going to play this song by Don Murdoch. He's a Canadian country western singer, and it hammers political correctness, and the song's title is "It May Be a Holiday to You, but it's Christmas to Me," encouraging people to say exactly what I'd be encouraging people to say, and that's be loud and proud and say Merry Christmas. And I'm going to try to get this. This is called The Christmas Song. And it came out a couple of years ago. I think it came out in 2016, if memory serves me correctly on this one. Don Murdoch lives in Colborne, Ontario, which is about 50 miles east of Toronto. And, I hope you'll like this. I don't know why we are having our usual trouble here. This is the Christmas song with Don Murdoch, and well, I think it was first Alex who sent this to me. This is the Christmas song with Don Murdoch. It may be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me.
It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. Christmas to me. I remember as a child, every Christmas Eve, we'd sing our favorite carols as we decorate the tree. Mom would tell us stories, we'd bow our heads and pray. Jesus our Savior was born that holy day. We'd pray for peace in the world so all can enjoy the dream meaning of Christmas, the birth of a baby boy. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. I put it on display each year for all the world to see. It might be a holiday to you, Christmas to me. Politicians try to tell us, take Christ out of the day, to hide all the symbols we used to celebrate. They say it might offend those who don't believe. Let me tell you, mister, now you're offending me. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. I put it on display each year for all the world to see. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. Why must everything be politically correct? Do is treat each other with some respect. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. I'm filled with tradition, love and family. I put it on display each year for all the world to see. It might be a holiday to you, but it's Christmas to me. Christmas to me. Merry Christmas, everybody.